You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Lenny Bernardo with the Open Society Fellowship Program, and it's a pleasure to have Alex Cooley here with us. Alex commenced his fellowship more or less in the last week or so, and we have a provocative title for his first brown bag here at OSI, Missed Opportunities, How the West, quote-unquote, Lost Central Asia. Alex's intellectual work, Alex has already published a couple of books in the last 24 months, most recently a book with the sort of fantastic double entendre, Base Politics, which has immediate relevance to what's transpired, as some of you know, in the last week with Kyrgyzstan's alleged deal-making with Russia over closing down a U.S. largely Air Force military base near the Bishkek airport, which Alex, of course, will touch upon. And I'm happy to say he's probably the world's foremost expert in the area. And so it's been quite timely. Alex's work in the context of his fellowship will be largely around the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a relatively new international regime, including China and Russia and several Central Asian states, that in some ways was set up as a security alliance, but has potentially taken on different forms, social and cultural, that Alex will flesh out, and in perhaps some ways is a kind of counter to, in fact, even the European Union. What I think would be also useful for Alex to discuss, when we selected him as a fellow, the economic crisis had not really taken hold in Russia or China yet, and I think it would be very useful to hear from him the degree to which economic catastrophe will influence and affect the future role of the SCO. But with that, I'm very happy to have Alexander Cooley with us.
Great, thank you. And it's a real pleasure to meet all of you. It's, again, an honor to be selected for the fellowship and to be among such neat fellows. And I just want to say off the bat, I slightly changed my presentation in light of what happened in Manassas. Maybe it was a mistake, but maybe it's too late to change it back. And not so much the substance of what I was going to do, because I think Kyrgyzstan is part of the overall story of, I think, how the West lost Central Asia. There are some other examples that I touch upon, and a lot of themes in this lecture are also presented in a piece I had for International Affairs Chatham House. I made some copies here, so feel free to pick one up, called Principles in the Pipeline, Managing Transatlantic Values and Interests in Central Asia. That was published in November. So what I'm going to do is focus on Manas, but through the prism of some of the broader points that I wanted to make. And please feel free to touch upon any other issues if you want, you know, Uzbekistan and more explicitly SCO, Turkmenistan. I'll talk about some of these things in the conclusion. It's no secret that Central Asia has been a renewed object or region of engagement, also object of engagement, for the transatlantic community during after 9/11. During the 1990s, the EU and the U.S., we were interested in. Of course, you had programs there and so forth, but it wasn't any kind of geopolitical priority. And really, post 9/11, sort of two events happen that make it a transatlantic priority. One is, of course, the need for basing and access deals to support the campaign in Afghanistan, not only for the United States, but also for ISAF, NATO partners. Of course, Germany has its own base in Central Asia in Termez, and happy to talk about that a little bit, because I think some of the arguments I'll make apply to it as well. And also, the second thing is, so, you know, interest in bases, and the other is interest in energy, right? And especially coming from the European Union, interest in energy security, possible sources for natural gas, for alternative non-Russia traversing pipelines like the Nabucco project and so forth. And so you see Central Asia also become a new focus for Brussels. You have the Central Asia strategy that's developed in 2007 under the German presidency and so forth. So these two dimensions, sort of bases and pipelines, which I will argue have very similar analytical dynamics going on in terms of the kinds of political relationships and dynamics that they encourage. They're both sort of what we call
in our business, sort of fixed assets that sort of trigger certain types of political effects. The overall argument I want to make is that the presence of these strategically important fixed assets has not helped the international community foster democratic development in the region. In fact, one can make the argument, and I have on other occasions with regards to Uzbekistan, that in fact they've done the opposite, that having fixed assets in the region, strategic interest in the region, has led the transatlantic community to tolerate active backsliding against democratic commitments, human rights violations, and poor governance in a way that it wouldn't have done so and didn't do so in the 1990s. Now, there are other complex parts of the picture. There's the Russian resurgence. There's sort of a decade or more so of learning how to deal with the West and so forth. So it's not just about the bases. It's not just about the pipelines. But they've played their role. And so I think when we think about Manas and what's going on now in Manas, we have to view the sort of the entirety of the evolution of that relationship. But, you know, in essence, I think the argument holds both for the EU's new type of engagement as well as sort of U.S. engagement with base hosts, especially Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. So let me confine most of my remarks then to the Kyrgyz Manas base, and I'll skip a lot of the technical details. But just to say, Manas is the second large facility we established in the region. We did so in December 2001. We needed something in addition to the Karshi-Khanabad base in southern Uzbekistan. The reason that Manas was favored, and this bears directly on this now, is that its runway had just been repaved, civilian airport, by a Japanese consortium, so it could accommodate a lot of the heavy aircraft for the cargo lifting, the refuelers, and so forth. So that's why it was selected as a site. A deal, it's actually referred to as a SOFA, but there is no status of formal status of forces agreement with Kyrgyzstan. It's a diplomatic exchange of notes, but this was passed by the Kyrgyz parliament in 2001. This established the basis for the first agreement, and which was subsequently revised in 2006. Manas, as you may know, now especially that the U.S. was evicted from K2, is for the Pentagon anyway, for CENTCOM, a critical asset in the Afghanistan campaign. Every month, about 15,000 U.S. personnel and 500 tons of cargo are shifted through Manas. And you have about 1,200 U.S. troops there on a rotational basis at any one time. Now, the first thing I want to emphasize about Manas is from the very beginning, from the very establishment in 2001, then-President Akayev saw this as an opportunity to sort of elevate his political standing, join the international coalition, and so forth. But the economic dimension in Manas, as I've written, was always critical to the arrangement. That is, and in fact, Ambassador John O'Keefe probably wishes he hadn't said this at the time, but sort of admitted at the time that offering economic incentives to the Kyrgyz was critical in getting the deal done, that this was a kind of inducement for cooperation. And the way that this was structured was not in terms of outright quid pro quos. The original money that the U.S. decided to pay for to the Manas Airport Authority just for the lease of Manas was quite small. It was $2 million. But rather, the whole system of contracts related to the base and its daily operations were funneled into Kyrgyz political insiders with links to the regime. So if any of you have seen David Cloud's interesting piece in the New York Times on the fuel contracts, and describing how the sort of subcontracts of these refueling contracts went to companies in the Akayev family, especially Akayev's son-in-law. So now the Pentagon, for its part, says that legally it didn't break any laws and that planes needed to be refueled. And this is, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I'll reserve judgment for number one. But number two is certainly true. A base has to be operated and so forth. But it's also true that the whole system of contracting and the kind of monopolies that were held on the Kyrgyz side also had a political dimension to it, which was sort of securing compliance with the regime.
Now, I should also mention that first year was rather exceptional in that there's a much more multinational feel to the base and to the presence, and I'll explain why this is important in a sec. In addition to the U.S., you had French, the Dutch, Danes, Norwegians, you had South Korean medical team. There's a multinational feel, and the multinational presence, especially in Bishkek at around the time, was palpable. Soldiers were allowed off base. There was a lot of frequenting of sort of Bishkek small stores, businesses, bars, restaurants, and so forth. Now it's a U.S. base, really since 2003. Yes, there's a couple of Spanish crews there. Occasionally some French rotate in and out, but it's essentially a U.S. facility. The other dimension of this is that under sort of the U.S. base commander, the base has stopped having formal contacts with the community. And this is sort of one of the kind of lessons learned in the Eurasia piece I set up, that this kind of frequent interaction between the base and the community is now limited under direct orders. And that lends a sense, in terms of the Kyrgyz community, that the base itself, it's sequestered. Maybe it's doing things it shouldn't be, that only insiders who are connected with contractors get access to the base. In other words, the base is a part of Kyrgyz life, and yet it's not. And I actually think that's had a negative PR type of consequence. Other types of economic incentives, the important one is that the two sides agree to international civil aviation standards of a fee schedule for takeoffs and landings. And international civil aviation fees are calculated according to weight. So basically, these large military aircraft take off. This is $7,000 that goes into the Manas Airport Authority. So the fee structure itself is quite unusual, again, designed to buy compliance. There's lots of different estimates as to how much then base-related activities are worth a year. Some say 60 million, some say 80, or about at the time. Kyrgyz, the official GDP is about $1 billion. So it's a good chunk. It's as Scott Horton sort of said, you know, this is the largest investment that the U.S. had in Central Asia that was never acknowledged as being its economic investment, right? And then I think that bears in mind. So there was a lack of transparency amongst these contracts. There was a sense that these revenues were unaccounted for. And a subsequent FBI investigation found that a lot of these Kyrgyz companies with ties to the Akayev presidency were involved in creating shell companies and offshore accounts for the purpose of money laundering, and they estimated the take to be about $100 million over the lifespan of the Akayev presidency. The Pentagon, by the way, was very upset by this cloud report when it came out. At the same time, this system depoliticized the basing issue, right? It made it something that wasn't really discussed. The media wasn't really running negative base stories. It wasn't really digging into sort of a lot of these basing arrangements. So what changes? A couple of things. One is so-called Tulip Revolution, or the ouster of Akayev, his replacement by President Kurmanbek Bakiyev, and the election in the summer of 2005, plus the U.S. eviction from Uzbekistan in K2. These two events lead Bakiyev to calculate that he can extract a lot more money for the base from the U.S. He sees Manas as now the final facility, and he can argue legitimately, and this happens all the time in kind of the history of U.S. base hosts, when you have a regime change, the new government tends to say, well, all of these deals benefited authoritarian practices and personally benefited previous regimes. We want to renegotiate this deal to benefit Kyrgyzstan as a whole. So Bakiyev at the time was advocating sort of a 100-fold increase in rent. He wanted from $2 million to go to $200 million. The U.S., as a further complication, has a longstanding policy that it doesn't pay rent for bases. So they were involved in negotiations for almost about a year, quite arduous negotiations, and they came up with a final package in 2006 of $150 million a year. Now, here's the issue, and this is where it starts to get politically messy. The Kyrgyz understood this package as quid pro quo for the base.
like $150 million a year. The U.S. refuses to pay quid pro quo, so in the wording on their side, they understood this as they will elevate the rent for Manas itself from $2 million to $18 million, and there will be service contracts and so forth that get counted in the 150, and the rest will be U.S. aid and U.S. government assistance programs, right, including democracy promotion, including Peace Corps, and so forth. And so the Kyrgyz side, well, you know, said, well, more the NSC side, you know, we never asked for Peace Corps. What is this sort of Peace Corps stuff? And the U.S. said, well, no, this is what we agreed to, right, that you'll have sort of $150 million total package. So they're very unhappy. Even though the deal is signed, they're very unhappy when it becomes clear to them that the $150 million is going to be $150 million cash. At the same time, in fall 2006, you have a string of incidents that are managed very poorly by the U.S. That really start turning Kyrgyz public opinion against the base. These include the supposed or alleged kidnapping of Major Jill Metzger in a Kyrgyz department store, where she shows up 2 days later and says that she was kidnapped, the threat of a bomb, when in reality there are all sorts of rumors as to what happened, but she was not kidnapped. And she was whisked out of the country. She made up the story to cover for some other things that were going on. More seriously, December 6, 2006, a guard outside the base, Zachary Hatfield, shoots and kills Alexander Ivanov, who is a Russian Kyrgyz and a driver for a fuel base service contractor who had actually been working there for 4 years. It's still unclear as to exactly what happened. Hatfield argues that Ivanov came at him armed with a knife. We still will probably sort of never know, but it's also clear that Ivanov was known, and that Ivanov, although, you know, some people tried to sort of, you know, malign him. Oh, he always seemed threatening and aggressive. It seems to me this idea that somehow he was acting like a terrorist, as sort of Hatfield's first declaration had it, you know, to me seems a little far-fetched.
So
Hatfield was not prosecuted, and in fact, this is where we start getting into some of the issues. So what happens then is, under the terms of diplomatic exchange of notes, U.S. effectively has diplomatic immunity. Right. Even if actually they had a NATO sofa, though, because he was on duty, he would still be under U.S. jurisdiction. So the Kyrgyz demand that he be turned over for prosecution. The U.S. says no. The biggest mistake the U.S. makes at this time, they do this all the time when you have these incidents overseas, is that they see this as a legal matter and not as a political and social matter. So rather than the base commander going with the Kyrgyz film crew apologizing, you had the U.S. ambassador go over there, express regret, and so forth. But the thing starts to spiral out of control. And the message, the narrative that develops is that the U.S. is uncaring, that it disregards Kyrgyz life. I know this is on the record, but I'll say it anyway. Another dumb mistake that had good intentions behind it was that the U.S. side offered half a year's worth of salary to Ivanov's widow as sort of a stopgap measure. He was also compensated by his firm. But then, of course, that gets picked up in the Kyrgyz media as Kyrgyz life is worth, you know, a couple thousand dollars to the U.S., right? And they should have known that was going to happen. But that's a narrative that becomes powerful. So it's not just the incident itself, it's its handling, right? Hatfield doesn't get prosecuted, he doesn't get turned over, he gets taken out of the country, right? And he still hasn't been disciplined or reprimanded over this. So there's a sense that, you know, the U.S. is just doing what it wants, right? It's not really treating the Kyrgyz as equal partners in any kind of way. So I want to give you this background just to sort of say that what happened this month didn't come out of nowhere, right? There was a predisposition in Kyrgyzstan against the base because of some of these sorts of issues. And the final piece of the puzzle, or I would say puzzle in the background on this, is President Bakiyev has a parliamentary election in December. He forms his Akjol party beforehand, and he took the advice of democracy promoters really well, formed a very strong party, and proceeded to win what was, by all international accounts, a very flawed election, possibly as flawed or more so than previous Akayev era elections. U.S. is muted on its criticism, and it's muted on its criticism because of the base that it's been hearing noises about it. It doesn't want to upset Bishkek. In any case, there's nothing it can do about the election, so why really draw attention to it? This is the same thing that happened in Uzbekistan, too. And we can talk about the Uzbek situation, too, but the same thing, the idea of having a fixed asset there mutes your criticism of the political situation. So with February declaration, Moscow comes in with a counteroffer, in essence, even though Kyrgyzstan claims that the two aren't linked. Of course, they are. It's offered emergency cash, $300 million, $100 million, $80 million in debt relief, which is actually not strings-free. It's in exchange for a share in a weapons manufacturing plant in Kyrgyzstan, a 48% stake. And the really interesting one that I'm happy to talk about more in Q&A is a $1.7 billion pledge to form a joint stock company to develop the hydroelectricity generating project at Kambarada, a project supposedly is going to increase Kyrgyz energy generating capabilities by 40%. So this is an attractive package. It's over $2 billion, considerably more than the kind of $150 million in Peace Corps and sundry assistance that the U.S. is giving at that time. So that's one part of this, right? Central government's broke. It's already started to delay payments on civil sector salaries, teacher salaries, social payments, and so forth. But Kyiv needs this cash infusion. Also, there's a domestic political reason to this, right? But Kyiv is trying to portray himself as the champion of Kyrgyz sovereignty, as standing up for what's right, of getting this sort of coup. And the opposition is finally united. It announced in January that it would start holding demonstrations in the spring. And it's no accident that I think, was it yesterday or the day before, President Bakiyev announced his intention to run for president again, either in 2010 or, if the Constitutional Court decides, in 2009. So the timing here is not coincidental either. There's domestic politics side of it. Finally, there's a new U.S. administration. And this is important, right? That throughout the campaign, President Obama, then candidate Obama, made a big deal about Afghanistan, how it would be his priority, how this would really be the focus of his regime, and the Kyrgyz were listening, right? So the timing of this helps the Russians, who want to show that they have a veto over access rights in Afghanistan, and they would like to bargain over other things, including national missile defense, NATO expansion, and so forth. And it serves the Kyrgyz regime, too, because this is where the U.S. was most caught off guard and most vulnerable about this. So let's put together some lessons here, which I think are generally important. Has the base in Kyrgyzstan expanded our engagement with the democratic development of the country? Superficially, yes. I would say substantively, no. Superficially, yes. There are still programs, in fact, you know, nearly $150 million worth of programs. The problem is that they're all within the context of the base. The base itself is the focus. And people at the embassy in Bishkek will tell you this, that you know, their number one concern is maintaining the base and its operations. The other stuff is of secondary concern. The Kyrgyz understand this. And I actually sort of kind of a sad aspect of this is talking to a lot of former students of mine from Soros Project AUK, now AUCA, who were just appalled. I mean, just saying that, you know, what happened to sort of democracy and human rights? All you guys care about is the base and funding the base. In fact, a lot of them had jobs on the base and so forth. So civil society activists, younger generation, have noticed, to say the least, where our concerns and priorities lie there. Also, ironically, some of the other things that we're doing there, like the university, become the target of anti-base protests by the Kyrgyz government. So any time that we do something concerning the base that the Kyrgyz don't like, they take it out on the university, right? Or they make life difficult for the university and some other programs. So it's channeled in an unhealthy manner there. But we ourselves have implicated everything else that we do in Kyrgyzstan, by that I mean the U.S. government, by bundling everything into this non-base rights package. The Kyrgyz fundamentally understand now that the U.S. needs this parking lot, this facility, more than it needs anything else out of Kyrgyzstan. That's the realization. That's what they picked up on. And any kind of other sort of attempts just aren't credible. And I think they're right about that. Now, has the base increased our leverage with the government to press for increased liberalization? This is where I would say no. I mean, I don't even think there's a doubt that the results here are mixed. I would say that not only our reaction to the parliamentary election, but also, you know, the sort of very heavy-handed approach that we're taking to these negotiations and sort of saying, you know, well, what's it going to take to sort of stay there and so forth. Make no mistake, if we pony up a substantial increase in rent that's going to go into Manas coffers, this will keep Bakiev afloat for a few more years. This will be enough resources for him to spread around during the election. The U.S. is forever going to be associated with supporting this regime for all of its goods and all for all of its likely ills, right? This will be the U.S. Manas election if the U.S. comes through with a package. And that's something that we really need to consider. Let me conclude, because we're going to wrap up, but I want to draw some other connections to what I see going on in the region. So how did the West lose? I mean, obviously, this is just a one example, but there are others. And I think this gets to this enduring debate that we've had a problem with as a transatlantic community, is how do we reconcile promoting our democratic values with maintaining our strategic interests? And the balance is precarious, and it's been tough, and we've opted for the interest side pretty consistently. And just to, you know, be fair here, this isn't just a U.S. problem. If you look at the history of, say, what's happening to the Germans in Uzbekistan, the use of the Termez base, which is a facility in southern Uzbekistan that supports the German ISAF mission, very similar, right? That the Germans have all sorts of programs with the Uzbeks. It seems like they're the only country that has programs now left with the Uzbeks. The Germans carry a very pro-Uzbek line in Brussels. They've been at the forefront of debates of loosening the sanctions against Uzbekistan. And many people attribute this to the Germans wanting to maintain their basing access at Termez. And your colleague Jackie Hale in Brussels had a very good line on this, which I'll quote her on, that really the debate within the EU about Uzbekistan and the sanctions revealed a lot more about the weakness and splits in the EU than it did anything about Uzbekistan, right? I mean, the whole evolution of you know, these debates about engagement and versus sort of sanctions and so forth really showed the divisions in Europe more than it did anything to sort of initiate real reforms within Tashkent. There's some other danger signs because there's no lack of bases in Central Asia. NATO is now using a facility in Turkmenistan, in Mari, an old Soviet airfield. It's been quiet, but if you go to EurasiaNet, you'll find a story on it. And the question is, does history repeat itself? Does the presence of a NATO facility in a country like Turkmenistan also constrain our ability to engage with them about political issues? I think, the jury's still out on that. The EU Central Asia strategy, energy security, right? Something I didn't have time to do because I focused on Manas. I see very much similar dynamics here, right? You have this working document about the EU Central Asia strategy, and it's this list of stuff that the EU wants. They want energy, and they want human rights, and they want energy, and they want rule of law, and they want energy, and they want democratic dialogue and promotion. And there's not really any kind of strategy out there as to how they're going to go about making the trade-offs and engaging these particular countries on these sorts of issues. And what's sort of fascinating is that EU leverage is incredibly powerful when a country wants to join the EU, right? When it actually wants to become part of the club, hey, you have to play by all the rules, otherwise you don't go in. Someone's laughing because we did just this the other day up at Colombia. But when the other side knows that they're never going to be a candidate for admission, it seems as if this relationship is a lot less asymmetrical than it is in normal conditionality agreements. And Central Asian countries have picked up on this, right? That there's these long-standing democratic dialogues, but at the end of the day, they pretty much see EU interests as being driven primarily by the energy issue, and they're going to act accordingly. Another concluding point I want to make, all of this is taking place in the backdrop of Russian pushback in the region against the influence of the West. And this is actually going to be the subject of my research, of the SEO research. But really what we see is not just on the military front, because I think that's defensive, and I don't like privileging the military all the time, but I think right across the way in terms of involvement of international NGOs, international organizations, their purposes, their functions, one of the most interesting programs that the SEO has is an election monitoring program, right, where member countries monitor each other's elections, and lo and behold, they've never seen an election they didn't like in Central Asia, and they follow the form of the SEO ODIHR monitors, but not the substance. And I think you're going to see the same attempt to sort of duplicate a lot of functions from sort of educational initiatives, establishing a Shanghai university, a kind of a Shanghai type of Erasmus program, to project financing, where you want to displace sort of IOs like the World Bank to the EBRD, to working on asylum laws and so forth. The concept of sovereign democracy is very popular in Central Asia now. Right, sort of this concept of sort of Mr. Putin, and this pushback against the West is taking a lot more dimensions than just the air base. This really is about wanting to sort of do away with these links that pressure you for these domestic political changes. In some ways, again, international community exerted a lot more influence in the 1990s than I see is going on now. I'd be happy to be corrected on that. So where does that leave us? It leaves us into this, with this age-old debate about what to do. Do we privilege values? Do we privilege interests? And, you know, one thing I want to end on is sort of saying the distinction is, to a certain degree, artificial, because one of the things we haven't done a very good job in, and this includes people like me in terms of writing about this on The Advocacy, is pointing out the kind of practical importance of values issues, right? That we know that better democratic governance also makes for a more reliable contracting partner, right? Countries that can, you know, credibly commit to keep the deals that they want and not go about breaking them, whether it's in energy, you know, power generation, basing agreements, or so forth. That's a very practical reason why we want to encourage rule of law, democratic governance, and transparency. We also know that political instability and strife is not good for our strategic interests. And yet, this is the road we're going down. If you're looking at a region, and I want to pick up here, final thought, on Lenny's point about the economic collapse in the region, this is serious stuff, and it's only going to add to sort of the buildup of social pressures, right? Not only in terms of sort of financial and banking failures, but Russia's weakness is bad news for all of the remittance-dependent countries in the region, like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. Sort of razor workers that actually just aren't getting paid or can't find work or are coming back, where are they going? They're going back to sort of a lot of rural areas, a lot of them are unemployed, a lot of them are young men, and that is not going to be beneficial, I think, in the long run in terms of promoting political stability. Very final point, and this is something I've been thinking about in anticipation for this. I wonder if it's time to start considering the lessons of U.S. engagement in post-Soviet Central Asia and kind of the deterioration of democratic governance that we're seeing, if this is actually one of the costs of Afghanistan that we can talk about concretely. And I wonder what that ledger starts to look like if we start adding up all these things. Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, you want to throw Kazakhstan in there, fine, or supporting the Tajik regime. I think we need to be honest about this. I'm not saying Afghanistan's not important. I'm not saying it shouldn't be supported. But if we're going to think in terms of policymakers, in terms of costs and benefits, this side of the ledger needs to get more attention. Because the number of countries that are being not sacrificed for the short term, but that we're turning away from in the short term to aid what we're doing in one country, the list is growing, and I think we need to pay attention to it. So with that, I'll stop right there, be happy to answer any questions you have or hear your thoughts on the matter.
Okay, Alex, thank you. That was wonderful, and you concluded by speaking in OSI language.
I'll get there in the end. Give me another year.
For sure. But if I can just ask very, very briefly, William Burns, who now Undersecretary, envoy to Iran, former Russian ambassador, went to Moscow yesterday to speak with the Russian Foreign Ministry. Barack Obama quietly dispatched him. Just curious, any immediate thoughts, what you think William Burns was bringing to the table in Moscow yesterday?
Oh, boy. Of course, I don't know. My sense was sort of expressing, you know, a sense of regret and displeasure that the timing of this was now, that this regime or this administration is committed to renewing its dialogue with Russia over all of these issues. It would be open to discussing Russian concerns, especially on things like missile defense, as Joe Biden has indicated, and that this isn't helping matters much. Russia cannot be allowed, I don't care sort of what side of the political spectrum you're on, Russia cannot be allowed to monopolize coalition access to Afghanistan. It's made that grab, and it's no accident that the Russians, after the Manas announcement, said, oh, we'd be willing to sort of provide you an access corridor for non-lethal types of shipments. But there's a sense that that would give Russia sort of a geopolitical lever, not necessarily for Afghanistan, but for all of these other things that it wants to have a dialogue with. So I think what was said was, you know, this is an international coalition effort. There are many things that we need to talk about that we will be happy to talk about, but doing this will make it more difficult for us to have the kinds of productive negotiations on some other issues that we wanted. Now, whether they're talking about Manas specifically, that I don't know. I have my own thoughts on that. You know, who knows, maybe I'll eat these words. Despite the negotiations going down, to me all the signs are there that in the immediate future this is a done deal. The question is, can there be some sort of medium-term arrangement through which maybe the U.S. leaves a cleanup crew, small contingent, maybe the 180-day evacuation get extended another 180 days, maybe they come back and do another deal. Because they've seen that we came back to Uzbekistan, albeit under German auspices and termes. And so I think that's something that the Kyrgyz actively think is sort of possible. And the Kyrgyz are also waiting on payment from Moscow. That's sort of another aspect to this. They want to make sure that, you know, the check comes, it clears, they have the cash before they go through on this. That's just my take. But I think Burns is giving the big picture to Moscow, that this is not being helpful to all the other things that need to be done in the U.S.-Russian relationship.
So you said that Russia cannot be allowed to essentially determine our access to Afghanistan.
Right.
And you stated that as a sort of very unnegotiable point.
Yeah.
And if that's unnegotiable, I mean, as an outsider, I look at this and I just see Russia deciding, well, you know, we're going to regain control over what we have always thought, rightly or wrongly, I don't care, but they have always thought is their backyard. And I think that they're using this economic crisis to
Absolutely.
Their advantage. They can offer a couple of billion dollars. And so I have two questions for you. One, if you agree with that analysis, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
We may be in an economic crisis of our own, but we have a lot more money than Russia.
Mm-hmm.
We can certainly outbid them.
Mm-hmm.
But then that leads you down this path of we're tossing democracy to the wolves.
Yeah.
So what actually, given your statement that we have to have access to Afghanistan on our terms, what do we do?
Yeah. Now, thanks for the question. A couple of things here. Let's also look at the context in which Russia is operating made this offer. At its height, Russia had $300 billion worth of hard currency reserves. In the fall, it's burned through $100 billion of those, $30 billion just in January. So $2 billion is a lot in the context of, you know, the sort of quicksands of what's going on and, you know, staving off what just seems to be an inevitable greater devaluation of the ruble. So that's one. So it's not clear to me that this is a comfortable deal for the Russians. Also, we can talk about how this energy plant stake is going to play out. I don't think this plays out very well either for the Russians or for the Kyrgyz. I think if you sort of project, you know, who are going to be the buyers of this increased electricity in the region, right? So the Kazakhs that can get electricity at sort of one-third of the cost, right? The Tajiks, we don't have money to pay for this. Who's actually going to, you know, domestic businesses in Kyrgyzstan that are broke or sort of politically connected? So what I see happening there is eventually, as the Kyrgyz government goes broke again in the future, this is a Russian way of then controlling this asset and having a sort of access to all the downstream distribution, sort of power generation in Central Asia. I think that's the long-term play anyway. What do we do? No, we can't outbid. And I sort of argued this in the International Herald Tribune op-ed, and some people sort of emailed me who vehemently objected. And we can't do it for a couple of reasons. First, this wasn't just the Kyrgyz renegotiating the deal at the time it was up. This was sort of a breaking of the deal. Now, it may not have been a very good deal, but they signed it. And if you're to abrogate this agreement, maybe this is a consequence that the U.S. has to deal with some of its own militarism and having hundreds of bases overseas. There will be a dozen to two dozen base hosts who will do the same, from Djibouti, no longer in Manta, but, you know, Ethiopians would do it, all the way around. You know, Iraqis would demand more in this sofa. So you would initiate a ratcheting up of the bidding price across the network in a way that would be, I think, very counterproductive, very damaging. Also, you would be saying, you know, essentially, yeah, this is money. This is here to sort of buy you off. And you would be funding this particular regime. This regime would be really the result of sort of the monies that you would be giving. So I see the domestic political angle as very dangerous. So what do? You try and exert... You try and make these arguments about economic crisis, right? You try and say, look, the Russians say they're going to deliver these things, but did they deliver these things to the Tajiks in 2004 as part of their basing agreement? No, they didn't fully follow up there. What makes you think that they'll do so here? You also make clear to the Kyrgyz that without the West there, their source of leverage vis-a-vis Moscow is also diminished, right? And this is where you have to sort of say that if we're forced to go to alternative routes, we will do so. And we're not going to come back in a year or 2 years' time. That this is sort of your choice. I mean, you have to be sort of hard about this. But if you give in to a financial demand, it makes, A, I think it's crude because it makes the whole thing about money, which it has been anyway. Yeah. Right. But you send all sorts of bad signals. And B, you're just propping up this regime now. And all the work that you've done in Kyrgyzstan for the last sort of 15 years, I think, gets thrown out. In terms of how much we need Manas, I'm not convinced. We need Manas like we needed K2. We got on well with K2. We'll do other deals. We'll do other negotiations. The question is, what do you give up in doing these other deals? If I've heard the one compelling argument about the indispensability for Manas is not on the supply end. It's in the contingency realm. That is, if something goes wrong in Afghanistan, if there needs to be, you know, an evacuation or quick, you know, airlifting out of some materials or peoples or so forth, Manas is the only facility in the region that can facilitate that. But in terms of the actual everyday supply, things can be patched together from other places. But, you know, to be honest, I'm not convinced that we need a double troop size in Afghanistan either, so I'm not particularly bothered by it. So,
yeah. Alex, thanks. That was very rich, and there's so many points you could kind of go off in any number of directions, and I'm going to leave some of those directions to people who know them better. I was really interested, though. I had a couple of questions, but of course, your final observation was, in a way, a very provocative one, and it led me to think a little bit about this coming OSI global forum that we're going to have in the fall about new forms of authoritarianism. And I think that, in doing so, we ought to look at the way in which U.S. militarism and authoritarian conduct of its war against its enemies internationally has created challenges for promoting open society. And indeed, the United States, when it confronted the aftermath of 9/11, had choices. It did not need to go the way it did. I think that's precisely the point. We live in the aftermath, a lot of those consequences. My two questions were things that you kind of only vaguely alluded to, and but I thought maybe you could spell out more specifically. compare and contrast the conduct and dynamics between Russia and the United States with the other case that was recently played out, Georgia and Kyrgyzstan. Bases, military, strategic interests, mm-hmm. You know, the security assets, mm-hmm. NATO, mm-hmm. the democracy rhetoric, without even talking about the seriousness of that rhetoric. There was the original, there was the Rose Revolution there, not a kind of ersatz rose in the tulip form that was replayed in Kyrgyzstan. So maybe compare and contrast. And then China, want to talk about, Russia, you know, the United States might put $150 million in someone's bank account, and the Russians may promise much more. But in reality, and Michael Hall will certainly know much better than I, if he's still here, the Kyrgyz economy, if you want to talk in financial terms, is an outlet, a receptacle, a plaything of China. If you ever been to the nearest big Chinese city to Kyrgyzstan, which is Xinjiang, in Xinjiang, Urumqi, which is a forest of 40-story glass and steel skyscrapers, the likes of which you wouldn't find, you know, if you took everything in Central Asia all together. So Kyrgyzstan is really, and then your work is on the SCO. And so talk a little bit about China, because they were somehow unmentioned.
Okay, great. Oh, wow, comparing Georgia and Kyrgyzstan. Perhaps I'll give you an unconventional view on this, which is I think they were both important assets to the U.S. administration. I think Kyrgyzstan's an important military asset, whereas I thought Georgia was an important relational political asset. Right. In Georgia, I think the difference was that BTC and energy corridor was invoked to justify supporting this regime that was obviously of very special importance to this administration. And we've talked about this in other forums, sort of why, in part because this was the supposed success story for the states. And so that gave them all sorts of access and influence that other countries in their position wouldn't have. But I felt that, you know, in retrospect, when we talk about how important Georgia was, it was always to sort of try and figure out a strategic interest that we would use to justify the relationship as opposed to the other way around, right? So I think that's the difference there. I think you're absolutely right in terms of the post-colored revolution trajectory in the two shows some similarities for sure. That, you know, you've seen sort of consolidation of power of the new revolutionaries. They've just consolidated the state apparatus, expanded it. Differences that the Georgians are getting a lot more money from us than the Kyrgyz are. So maybe the Kyrgyz learned from that color revolution too, right? And we're expecting $1 billion sort of aid package, who knows. On China, you're absolutely right, they're an important player. A little bit different. I tend to agree with sort of Steve Kotkin's take on this from a couple of weeks ago, whereas, you know, the fundamental difference in general terms is that the Chinese don't like overtly challenging U.S. power. And I think that's actually true of Central Asia, too. There's a big narrative since 2005, the SCO declaration, that China and Russia are the big bullies and they're forcing the Central Asia countries to sort of kick the U.S. out. That wasn't true of 2005. It was, you know, this was Karimov who went to Putin and said, let's issue this declaration. Putin was like, great. And the Chinese and the Kyrgyz were more reluctant. I mean, they went along with it. This isn't Chinese priority. The Chinese priority, as you mentioned, is economic in the region. And this is what terrifies the Russians when you talk about the SCO, right, as well as the Central Asian countries too, that if the SCO were to be turned into a free trade zone, a free economic zone, it's not only Kyrgyzstan that would become an economic outpost of China, right? It would be, you know, most of the region would be absorbed. So instead, what you're trying to do is have limited engagement on very specific things like, you know, financing of infrastructure, telecommunications, or you know, limited projects that you can bound and not allow this, you know, this Chinese economic power to just sort of devour the region. I think that's the tricky bit that both Russia and the Central Asian states are trying to manage. But
Chinese are very, very active in terms of, again, development of these sort of projects. And I think what you were sort of indicating is that they follow a similar model in the sense that, you know, they don't demand good governance clauses. They don't sort of release their aid into sort of official sort of aid statistics and so forth. They bundle everything together. So tell us what you need to get this deal done. Want us to build a school? We'll build a school. Want this highway repaved? We'll repave the highway. Want a scholarship for your kid in Beijing? Sure. It's all just sort of thrown in there. It's a different way of doing business.
I agreed with many points in your discussion, but we'll contest. I think I have issue with your last statement about democratic values being sacrificed just to assist one country. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's the way that the situation in Afghanistan can be framed at all.
Mm-hmm.
Afghanistan had 3 decades of brutal violence, mm-hmm. and assisting Afghanistan was not really a priority then, and I don't think that's what led the United States to invade Afghanistan in 2001. It was a strategic interest. It was part of the war on terror and mm-hmm. the Bush Doctrine
mm-hmm.
that defined U.S.'s involvement in Afghanistan. And it was looking at stabilizing the region as a whole and
mm-hmm.
looking at the instability in Afghanistan and the ways that I think most Central Asians would agree that instability in Afghanistan was problematic for the Central Asian countries
mm-hmm.
in terms of the extremist groups that were
mm-hmm.
building networks throughout the region.
Sure.
And I also want to say that the dilemma of the between democratic values and U.S. strategic interests is also being played out to the detriment of democratic values both in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's part of a much broader
Absolutely.
Issue, and it's not simply being charitable to Afghans that things are playing out as they are.
Yeah, no, thank you. Actually, I would, of course, put Pakistan number one on the ledger of countries, right? Is our interest in stabilizing Afghanistan and controlling it versus promoting democracy? Yeah, it could be. I mean, I think a lot of people are committed to trying to make this somehow sort of work. So, I think my point was more on this issue of kind of what are the kind of sacrifices that we're making that are not being talked about in the press. And Pakistan, I think, is getting attention, not enough, given what's been going on there and what our policy has been. But the post-Central Asian states, I would add to that column. But your point is well taken.
Yeah, another issue that you mentioned was, another issue that kind of just shows us also that the Russian response or the Russian influence in the region does not really follow a grand strategy or
mm-hmm.
a grand design, because this becomes clear amongst other things when you look at the Russian promise to develop Kyrgyz hydropower assets, because a couple of weeks ago Medvedev was in Uzbekistan and he kind of like did the exact opposite thing with Turkmenistan. Actually, I'm just waiting for the Uzbek reaction on that offer. So it's going to be an interesting one, what the Uzbeks have to say to Medvedev in kind of developing the things that he had promised the Uzbeks to kind of stop in Tajikistan.
I don't know how much more I can add to that. I mean, I think the strategy would be there if they had the resources to do it. I think the strategy is a more long-term one. But they don't have the resources to do it anymore. And so then the question is now, what do they prioritize in this sort of economic crisis? And maybe this is also the window of opportunity in terms of the Kyrgyz to act now, because you know you're not going to be in a position to in 1 or 2 years' time. So, it's open. By the way, just, fair is fair also on the Russian base in Kant in Kyrgyzstan. This is not a paragon of sort of democratic engagement and, positive external military influence either. There's been a lot of
troubles associated with that. Sort of the most notorious one was, I think, a Falcon smuggling ring that was discovered that was being operated by the Russians out of Khan and that was going into seriously smuggling Falcons into the UAE. In them, yeah.
Go hunting with dolphins.
So.
Yeah.
Falcon would suit you, actually, Lenny. I would not say that. But yeah, no, I mean, it's well taken. But, you know, very expensive projects. Moscow's running out of cash. I'm not sure how they can follow through with all this.
So is it always zero sum? Mm. In other words, the more mm-hmm. we are committed to securing these fixed assets, the more we sacrifice, you know, our ability to promote democratic governance in the region. I mean, in other words, if we assume that going forward we're not going to stop pursuing bases and pipelines, et cetera, in the region, I mean, is it about just doing less of that, or is it about when we do it, we do it somehow differently in ways that is less
of a problem? I mean, that's a great question. It gets to, like, the heart of the dilemma. Look, I would like to see a few fewer bases around the world, right? I mean, I've sort of, you know, when I talk to people, they're always like, oh, this is so vital and that is so vital. And it's always so vital until it's not there. Like, I mean, I've never sort of seen DoD kind of voluntarily give up a facility and not call it vital. Although that was also a very poor negotiating strategy, by the way, in the context of sort of the Kyrgyz, telling them how critical and vital Manas was for sort of 6 months. It's like, hello. and I noticed Gates, actually in his comments 2 days, said it's not vital anymore, right? So it's like little too late. They made the same mistake with the Uzbeks, too. Maybe we can get some OSI fellowships, get DoD to take some basic negotiating classes or not. I don't know. But that's a dilemma. The problem in this case, I mean, there's a couple problems. One is we don't like to publicize basing agreements, and that leads to a few things. First, it leads to these agreements being done on a very kind of tacit and ad hoc kind of basis, that you just sort of patch it together, and then becomes all about tactical responses as opposed to having a long-term view, what you want from this country, you know, where are you going to be 2, 3, 5, 8 years? You don't publicize bases, too, because you don't want to draw attention to it. You also don't want the other side or other bases to know what you're giving in Kyrgyzstan and what you're giving in Djibouti or what you're giving in Manta. So that's part of the logic of not doing it. But it really prevents sort of broader planning. The problem in Central Asia specifically, so it's a general problem, but the problem specifically with the fixed assets in Central Asia was that the needs of CENTCOM were clearly prioritized by everyone over everything else. And CENTCOM was left to deal with base-related issues. And the State Department essentially worked for State CENTCOM in the context of sort of K2 and Manas. You saw some glimmers of some daylight between them in the last days after Andijan. That's fair enough. But by that time, the die had been cast. So what we need is what we should have in government in general, that every part of U.S. government and U.S. foreign policy is equally vigorous and assertive in its perspective as to, you know, why this country is important, what we need to get out of it, you know, so that the whole range of interests and values is expressed. And the problem in Central Asia was that this was only about basing access for the war on terror for a very, you know, for that period of time, sort of after 2002. So, for instance, you know, I think in Iraq, you know, you're having some of those debates now a little bit more. I mean, it's not just, you know, I don't want to throw Iraq on the table, but it's a little more balanced in terms of our view of, you know, politically, how is this going to get played out and so forth. Central Asia, actually, I would argue not as much.
One question that comes to mind. So I guess a factual question. If you have any information about this, be interested to hear. Now that the U.S. has been kicked out of K2, and it looks like, I'd say The Manas seems to be also more or less a done deal. I think there's some wiggle room still, but things, the indications seem to be that it's done. So the question comes to mind is, well, there are other countries in Central Asia. There are other regimes in Central Asia that are very short on capital right now, both political and material, specifically Tajikistan, for example. And I think they would be, in some ways, perhaps perfectly happy to come to some kind of arrangement.
Mr. Rahman has expressed his willingness.
So I'm just wondering what you think about that, what you've heard of discussions around that. Certainly there have been rumors flying for a number of years, ever since the end of K2, about Tajikistan as an option. I'm just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it would be, there would no be one alternative that would be set up, but rather you would sort of increase sort of the activity of multiple points. And Dushanbe Airport could do some of the lighter stuff, but it's not equipped for the heavy stuff that they were doing out of Manas. But it could be, it could, and it was for 2002 and 2003, right? I mean, it ran sort of a lot of missions. So certainly they could go back there. This rail link to Uzbekistan is a done deal. That'll be rolled out pretty soon, officially. They can keep going under German auspices in Termez. They can expand Turkmenistan. They could cut a deal with the UAE countries. I mean, it would be a long way to go, but if they had to do it, they could do it that way, too. So there's some, there's some options there. None of them are as good. None of them are great, but they've adjusted before. I think your point gets to Tajikistan, exact same, if not worse, set of social and political circumstances. So, right, so what kind of deal are you going to sort of cut with the Tajiks? What kinds of relationships are you going to encourage over the medium term? Especially, you're talking about a country that really is starting to be on the brink. And I had a look at the crisis group's report that came out yesterday. And, it sounds about right to me. Is this only going to sort of further lock you in with a particular regime? Yes. One caveat on this. The Central Asian regimes are very good at, and they've learned to do this, and I mean this in sort of an objective and analytical way, sort of playing external actors off one another. And they did this all throughout the 90s with sort of external assistance providers, donors, and so forth. So this kind of, some people call it multi-vectorism, I call it more kind of, multi-balancing. And so we need to realize that in our dealings here, right? That at some point, the prospect of just having contacts with Moscow and Beijing is not attractive to these regimes. And we need to sort of realize that. But to do that, we also need to have more of a transatlantic strategy on some of these issues, and that's been a little bit of a problem too, and we're as much to blame as Brussels for that.
I wanted to, if nobody else has, I wanted to ask another question about your theory about what your wish, your recommendation about what might be a more reasonable way of conducting our foreign policy, and whether there are precedents in U.S. history for that. I was just thinking, I was trying to imagine, what is the largest series of basing deals that was ever cut in U.S. history before this? And that was Lend-Lease, right?
Yeah.
And then in the Cold War.
Back,
And just think about things like, what was the role of the State Department in the Second World War versus, who are the names that you remember from the Second World War? Marshall, Eisenhower, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
What in times of crisis, is it reasonable? I mean, you saw how Rumsfeld big-footed even Colin Powell, who was a, former head of JCS on Iraq, then it's nice to say that the State Department, unless you've been there, ought to have as much, and they ought to have as much of a voice. But I remember, actually, that it was very interesting because I worked with a former DOD official in Uzbekistan, and their attitude towards the State Department was, we've got the planes. They are always looking to hitch a ride. We've got the resources. These guys are always looking to hitch a ride or mooch some favor off of us, and they just look down on them with complete scorn. And this is,
in the mid 90s,
in fact, the U.S. military led the relationship. So how reasonable is it to expect that type of even-handed relationship at a time when the Obama administration is populating a whole host of nominally civilian jobs with former military types. The securitization of U.S. foreign policy is something that really has to be thought of. And especially maybe the economic crisis will offer some other mode of prioritizing our interests.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not here sort of necessarily picking on DOD, but, you know, facts are facts, right? You know, you guys managed this thing in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, and how did it turn out in both of them? It's a very simple competence question. You know, how did your bargaining turn out? How did your PR turn out, right? How did your deals turn out? Not very well. So I think the question becomes, you know, should DOD be doing all of this other stuff? Should they be dictating who is to get what in exchange of basing rights? Or should that be where it's traditionally been, in the hands of the State Department, who understands the issues and the implications of it, and let DOD conduct what they do well, assert their military operations? I think we've gotten confused a little bit in terms of the roles, and I just think that the sort of results speak for themselves. Two, this has always been an issue, and it's fascinating during the Cold War. And we could go down a long list of cases. The two I like to sort of throw out there are, you know, the case of the Madrid Pacts in '53 and Franco, right, where we established basing deal with the Franco regime at a time which was completely ostracized by all of Europe, right? And so this was a lifeline to Franco, right? And sort of that then paved the way for a concordat with the Vatican, and then sort of the eventual admission in sort of the UN. And at the time, U.S. defense officials go, this is nothing to do. This is not a tacit recognition of the regime. Well, it's like, you can say that it's not, and you can believe that it's not, but just being there makes it so, right? And I think that's the problem. It's always been difficult to divorce sort of your presence from the regime presence. The Azores, a very good example under Kennedy, sort of Democrat, right? When he was pursuing decolonization policies in the 60s and wanted to come in to really encourage sort of African liberation, and sort of in the first UN resolutions against what the Portuguese were doing, especially in Angola, the Portuguese said, we're kicking you out of the Azores if you don't stop this UN decolonization stuff. And they did a U-turn within sort of 6 months. They stopped issuing these declarations. So there's a long history of this kind of stuff. One way around it would actually, this is a recommendation of the State Department, is I think if we need things for operational reasons, there's no reason that we shouldn't pay a sum for them in a rent, but do so in a transparent and obvious kind of way. Then that gets you out of the idea that you're sort of throwing everything together in one garbled kind of relationship. It also gets you out of this perception that somehow so-and-so is your good security partner. And this is more of what happened with Karimov. That if you're just paying for a parking lot, which you need, then be clear what it is, you know, what the purpose is that you're there for. And don't then throw all of this other stuff in to sort of cover the fact that you're paying for a parking lot. I think that could be one adjustment. I don't think that would solve everything. But it would be sort of a one way to sort of have, I think, more leverage in the negotiation and not be so tied to the particular regime that you're cutting the deal with.
Yes, sir.
Hi. A comment and a question. When you were speaking, I kept thinking of Liberia. I mean, partly because I'm working on it at the moment, but. In 2007, the U.S. government let it be known that they were thinking of Monrovia as a potential site of a regional command.
Yep.
And Ellen Johnson Sirleaf jumped on that. You know, it's a fragile democracy. It's very prone to coups. There are former warlords with soldiers who haven't been demobilized. There's a U.N. force of 12,000 people, which is going to leave at some point. And the big question is what will happen after it leaves. And the government pushed the U.S. very, very hard to have its regional command in Monrovia, essentially to make that democracy coup-proof. And that's probably correct. So the comment is that, you know, the relationship between American military interests and democratic values is very circumstantial. You know, it depends on what's going on in the country. A question is how China plays the same game.
Yep.
I mean, China isn't interested in democratic values, but it's certainly interested in long-term stability. and faces the same tension of short-term exigencies and long-term stability. And you touched on that, but how well is China dealing with the same tension?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about what's going on in Africa, I personally see AFRICOM as very much a reaction to what China is doing in the region. And the whole idea that this regional command, no, it's not going to be devoted to war fighting. It's going to be devoted to sort of peace building and humanitarian work and all this kind of stuff. And there's two dangers with that. One, I think what the Kyrgyz situation shows, as well as what K2 shows, is that it doesn't really matter what the size of the presence is, or its footprint, or even what it's doing. U.S. base is a U.S. base. And this is sort of one thing sort of American planners really need to understand better. It doesn't matter if the facilities like it is in Wiesbaden or Okinawa or something. Base doesn't have to be massive for it to be politically important. And we've already seen signs of this in Africa, right? This Pan-Sahel initiative, right, that EUCOM started and sort of got all these sort of African countries in Sahara together, all pointing to sort of phantom terrorists running around the desert because they wanted the goodies. This is a dynamic that you're going to sort of encourage through this kind of, I think what Anthony was talking about, sort of this militarization of your relationship. How could it not? I mean, if you were a leader in a government, how would you not inflate or elevate a threat to get U.S. engagement? Of course you would. It's the most kind of rational political strategy that's out there. Even better if you're being courted by the Chinese at the same time, right, for your sort of mine or your power plant or whatever. Then you have dual leverage. So the problem as I see it is we come from a certain legal tradition, a certain set of values. We're rarely perfect. But part of what differentiates or should differentiate the way the transatlantic community operates from how China and Russia operates is that we don't just directly wire money to Swiss bank accounts to get deals done, and we don't – sometimes we might, but we shouldn't officially. If we start playing the Chinese-Russian game, A, we're not as good at it, right? So we're going to be sort of outcompeted. B, we lose everything about the values part of the equation that's appealing to us, right? Partners don't turn to Russia or China because of their values, right? They might turn to them for other reasons. So if we give up on the value side of the dimension, as imperfect as it is, as inconsistent as it is, as hypocritical as it is at times, we also give up, I think, in some ways, our biggest asset or whatever it happens to be. And so I'm really concerned about AFRICOM because I think even though the intentions are there to do it differently, this is going to be proper, you know, Barnett and his Esquire article said, oh, this is going to be colonialism does right. That's a frightening thought to me. Right, and there are enough signs in Africa, from the Ethiopian army to what happened in the Pan-Sahel initiative, to what went on in Kenya after the elections, because we had sort of facilities in Manda and in Mombasa. I just see the same patterns playing out again there. No, I hope I'm wrong. Yes, sir.
I have two questions. As a people who's from Kyrgyzstan, it's question from my side, I mean. I would say first that very, very competent research and speech, absolutely true. As a former member of parliament, government, I can say that very interesting and very competent. You know very well our situation. My questions are, the last information from our parliament, today's information, parliament...
I'm sorry, I can't even turn on my own phone.
Parliament today stopped discussion of this question.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
The first question is bargaining continuing between
yes.
U.S. and Kyrgyzstan or between U.S. and Russia? The first question. Second
yep.
question, in case of closing a military base, I would like to know... American policy regarding Kyrgyzstan, regarding democratization
yes.
processes.
Yes.
How is it going to be? Is that level going to be increase or decrease?
And that level.
Yes, that yeah. level. And American government's relations to our Kyrgyzstan, to Kyrgyzstan or Kyrgyz president personally? How is it going to be, your opinion?
Okay, well, is bargaining continuing? I think the answer is yes. It's continuing intensively. The question is, what's the Kyrgyz strategy here? Is the bargaining, I mean, there's really two, well, I mean, there might be more, but I see two basic possibilities, right? The first is that the Kyrgyz are telling Washington outright, make a counteroffer, given what's on the table, and you can keep Manas. I don't think they're doing that. I think that would be a tremendous embarrassment to Moscow if the U.S. ended up staying in Manas. You know, for Sir Bakiyev to go to Moscow, make a big hoopla, announce this with Medvedev, and, you know, given also the FSB ties between Kyrgyz Republic and Russia, I don't think it would be a politically wise choice on Bakiyev's part. But maybe that's what he's doing. I don't think so. The second possibility is, I think what I said is that they're waiting for the check to come in and declare, right? That they're waiting for the money from Moscow to be delivered, not just the promise for the money, the actual money, the emergency funds, and at which point then the parliamentary go-ahead will be given to issue the final eviction. That's my sense of it. I have no firsthand knowledge of this. I mean, I don't know what you're hearing from your sources. In the case of democratization, you know, officially the Kyrgyz government, and just spoken to official in the Kyrgyz government, says that they're committed to rule of law and poverty relief and democratization and so forth. Sure, we want all these things. The question is, what are we willing to sort of overlook? Or when we don't get those things, we don't get adequate progress, is what we would like to see, what do we do about it? So I don't see that the programs aren't going to be there, although if we are evicted by Manas, it's going to be a lot harder to go to the U.S. Congress and say, you know, can we please have aid levels for next year at the same level last year? And actually that's another recommendation I would say in terms of like what you would say to the Kyrgyz, Mark, in answer to your question a long time ago. And you say, no, Congress is not going to take lightly to this sort of, you know, showing us up like this. But I think I think it's very difficult because it's not just the U.S. base. It's this whole kind of backlash that we've been discussing. It is the influence against, you know, elections, against the presence of NGOs, against human rights concerns. This has been brewing now for 3, 4, maybe 5 years since 2004, and we're seeing sort of the cumulative effects. And Bakiyev is seeing just how far he can push things, and he's pushed things pretty far. So I don't see why he would all of a sudden become sort of a welcome Democrat, right? Where's the pressure going to come from? Is it come from here? Is it going to come from Brussels? Brussels, who isn't engaged with Kyrgyzstan much to begin with, right? Is it going to come from Germany? Probably not. So, you know, as long as there's a crisis in the country, I think he's going to do whatever he can to thread the needle, get this election on board, pay off the necessary people, win the election, and then he'll deal with the aftermath in the aftermath. You know, and when it comes down to it, you know, so, you know, Russia takes over your power plant and so forth. That happens in 5, 10 years' time. By that time, you know, who knows what the world's going to look like. So I'm afraid this is a very short-term strategy for Bakiyev, just from the way it seems to me. And medium-term, I'm not sure it's good for the Kyrgyz Republic as a country, but it's his short-term political strategy. But I'd like to talk to you more about it.
Alex, to use Anthony's words, this is incredibly rich. And we are thrilled to have you here as a fellow, because as you can hear from people at OSI and outside, there are a range of diverse questions that we're contending with in our thinking, that U.S. foreign policy is contending with in theirs. And it's going to be great to hear more from you in the days and weeks ahead. So thank you so much.
No, it's my pleasure, and thank you very much for the great discussion.